Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's hear it for our own Eugene V. Debs, the one and only super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
What? Let's have a dab for our own Debs, Max Williams. Everybody do a dab right now. We're doing it together.
We're doing it.
Dab.
Hope you're doing it too while you're listening, folks. and if your friends ask you, tell them about the show. They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with my ride or die, Mr. Noel Brown, none other.
Hello. Sorry for the lag in responding to your amazing big up of myself, Mr. Noel Brown, the one and only. I guess that's true. You know what's funny though, Ben? I've grown up with a name like Noel, and you don't get a lot of Noels in America. But the only ones that I know of are from the UK, and they're relatively famous. There's Noel Fielding from the Mighty Boosh and Great Gallagher. British Bake Off fame. You got your Noel Gallagher. You got your Noel Coward. What are some other fame? Anybody know any other famous Noels? There's the first Noel, of course, Jesus Christ himself.
There's also good friend of mine. I think good friend of yours as well. Noel Flores, who is one of the marketing demigods and event coordinators here at iHeartMedia.
Oh yeah. Of course.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Excellent taste in leather jackets.
Oh my God. Are you kidding? Max, this is the person who will lead us to the correct leather jackets. I've been so weirded out for many years. Our good friend, Mr. Matt Frederick of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and numerous true crime podcasts, has had this amazing leather jacket. I've asked him, you know, like, how do I commit to this? How do I get a good leather jacket? And one time Matt told me something like, well, you see it, you try it on, and when you know, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Some things run small, some things run large. It's all about what fits you. And I really do envy the big wigs, the types that Eugene Debs might have been fighting against that get tailored suits. Although in this day and age, most anybody can afford a tailored suit. You can get, what is that, that tailored suit company that we used to do?
Suit Supply?
Yeah, well, there's Suit Supply, and it still ain't cheap. Yeah, exactly. That's the one. It still ain't cheap, but it really, man, the difference between like a suit off the rack that fits you. I sound like I'm shilling for suit makers, but the difference is night and day.
Now, I got a black window pane suit earlier this year tailored, and it was like $300-something bucks. It wasn't bad at all, and it fits great. It looks great. It fits great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is this is the time where we want to thank everybody who didn't write a review immediately saying, ah, these guys with their banter. We hope that you enjoy it. We love, of course, your opinions, ridiculous historians, on everything addressed in the show, whether or not it is, you know, whoosh, whoosh, officially part of the episode. But we've been through a heck of a week. We've got a book coming out now called Stuff They Don't Want You to Know for another podcast, Noel and I Do. And that book has been met with pretty great reviews. So if you want to review something, please do go review that on Amazon. There's other big news before we get to Deb's. Oh my gosh.
Can I say one thing really quickly about the book? My aunt, or I guess my aunt-in-law, I don't know, she's my uncle's ex-wife. What does that make her? No idea. Was a librarian, is a retired librarian, and commented on a post that I made about the book and had seen the reviews in Kirkus Review and I think Book there's another one. There was a second one. And said that, like, those are the go-to review sites for librarians choosing things to buy for libraries or to include in libraries.
That's so crazy.
That's pretty great, man. Mm-hmm. Good job, Ben. I mean, we did it together to a degree. But, man, in your voice. You knocked it out of the park. It's just such a fun read, and I'm just so proud of you, man.
Oh, man, I'm proud. I'm proud of all of us, you know. Also, it's so weird you mentioned this, Noel. I have an aunt. I have many teachers and educators in my family, and one of my aunts who lives out in Austin, Texas, is a librarian and said something similar. So at least we're going with the crowd of the people we really want to impress.
The literati.
The literati. Yes, just so. And this is the second part of a two-part episode on a guy that may not be familiar to a lot of Americans today, but a person who has certainly affected your life if you live in the U.S. and you're hearing this now. His name, Eugene V. Debs. Debs to his friends. His street name, Max's Daddy, because in addition to being our super producer, yeah, it's at the top. Max took point on this on the research for this. So Max, we're going to defer to you along the way, but I wanted to, I think just in the interest of transparency, we need to hit that. You describe Eugene Debs in the title of our research here as Max's Daddy, as your spiritual father. What's going on?
I really like Eugene V. Debs. I learned about him, I think, I took an AP US history class in high school, and that's like the first time I learned about him. He's not really someone who gets taught to you in, like, you know, your traditional public education classes.
But AP, huh?
Yeah, yeah. But, like, you know, that's the class where you really get to dive into it. And it's like, wow, this guy's kind of important. So it was learning about, like, how this guy is really influential on all of our lives, especially for stuff like Social Security and the right to unionize and stuff like that. I've always just been a big fan of this guy.
And can I just add too that, Max, you have been part of the effort of iHeart producers, employees in the podcast network to do that very thing. And I can't imagine that you would have been as interested in that or, you know, schooled if you hadn't discovered Eugene Debs early in your, you know, career.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been a part. I mean, I will say, like, you know, I was raised, I think first generation white collar is probably the best way to describe it. Both my parents have white collar jobs, but they were raised in a very blue collar, like, Detroit area. Many people from union jobs and stuff like that. And that's how, like, cities like that were able to, you know, people have these livelihoods so they can have families and not be, like, you know, so tight on money all the time because they were able to get, you know, fair and equal pay and wages and stuff. So it's stuff that I very much believe in and everything like that.
Well, it's no accident, or maybe somewhat of an accident, that we also just recently did an episode on the Luddites and the, you know, fabric or textile workers early in that industry. There were certain skilled workers who could kind of name their price and could really command a lot of perks and things like that. And then as industrialization took hold, that became less of a thing. And I think the reason unions are important is to kind of re-level the playing field and make sure that those in power and those that kind of have their hands on the purse strings and all of that aren't able to just, you know, completely diminish the idea of a fair wage and treat people just like human capital.
And that's a struggle that continues. You know, here in 2022, if you live in the United States, fellow ridiculous historians, you have to be aware, this is an apolitical point, that most other nations, this is a true story, most other nations have much better maternity leave or paternity leave, things like that. The again, the struggle continues. And wherever you find yourself on the political platform, I'm going to go ahead and take a wild guess. Don't kill me in the reviews here. I would take a wild guess. You like things like weekends. And you like things like fair pay. So this is something that happens that happens with Debs. When we left Debs in part one on Thursday of our show, we had left him right around the time that he was learning, some would say being radicalized, in jail while incarcerated. At this time still, he said that he was still thinking of himself maybe more as an Americanist rather than a socialist. But here's where we find him now. It is 1896, and he is endorsing a U.S. presidential candidate named William Jennings Bryan. And Bryan is doing something really interesting in his campaign. He's running on multiple tickets. Yes, he's running on the Democratic ticket. He's also running on the ticket of something called the People's Party. Spoiler alert for any non-presidential campaign buffs. Bryan doesn't win. He loses to a guy called William McKinley. And William McKinley is funded by some of the very same business entities that sought to break Debs' union movements with railroad workers.
That's right. And if I'm not mistaken, Max, this whole thread in the story is maybe what led this to being considered ridiculous because of some of the situations that that Debs found himself in while also running a presidential campaign.
Yeah. There's some of the these guys, you know, who are supporting like people like McKinley don't exactly like things that Debs is doing and saying, and some actually basically all of which are not bad in my opinion, but it's kind of, I would say the ridiculousness of this story is the amount that Debs wants to help people, no matter how much consequences he faces for it.
Yeah. I think that's well said. You know, this, there's a thing that people started saying that was circulating in the zeitgeist of the time. And folks would say, well, President McKinley was elected by money, and Bryan was the people's candidate. William Jennings Bryan, by the way, is worth an episode all his own. I think we can agree. Here's what happens. This is enough to really sour Debs. Our boy Gene sees what he, what from his perspective is systemic, dangerous corruption. The system is rotting from within, like a wound that creates gangrene. And so he says, this two-party system, this Democrat-Republican thing, it's kind of a con job. You know what I mean? It's sort of a trap. It's a false dichotomy. And to this end, he proclaims himself publicly as a socialist in one of several railway magazines, periodicals he writes for. It's January 1st, New Year's Day, 1897. He comes out and he says, the result of the November election has convinced every intelligent wage worker that in politics, per se, there is no hope of emancipation from the degrading curse of wage slavery. I am for socialism because I am for humanity. And this is a quote we mentioned in part one. He goes on, money constitutes no proper basis for civilization. Arguably true. You don't have to agree, but he makes some good points, huh?
He definitely does. And that June at the yearly meeting of the American Railway Union, Debs made a big splash by founding the Social Democracy of America Party. And as parties sometimes do, whether it's political or just, you know, a get-together, things, people break away. They go their own way. They're their little cliques that form. And so the Social Democracy of America Party splintered. And Victor Berger and Debs joined what ultimately became the Social Democratic Party.
Hmm. And then there's another evolution, right? In 1901, this outfit starts calling itself the Socialist Party of America. And Debs has some rousing quotes. Again, he's a great orator, right? He's a polemical writer. He's a fantastic speaker. He's one of those guys who starts shouting and his forehead and his temples get the veins popping out. And, you know, he's, as we would say in the American South, he takes people to church when he speaks. And right. He really does. And we've got this other quote here. He equates socialism. One of the prime things that he sees as a tenet of socialism is public ownership over what are called the means of production. Noel, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I do want us to trade off really cool, like lambasting, galvanizing quotes from our boy Gene. So could you do We the People a favor and maybe give us an approach of this quotation from his speech to miners in Illinois and Kansas in 1899.
Arouse from your slavery, join the Social Democratic Party, and vote with us to take possession of the minds of the country and operate them in the interest of the people.
That's me clapping. Oh, Max Thank is you. Clapping too. Oh, yeah. God.
Multiply that, though, by like the voice of the people, you know, mm-hmm. and then you have a truly rousing round of applause.
And envision a lot of veins popping out while he's saying it.
Oh, so many.
A lot of veins.
So many. Also, people are loving these sorts of speeches. He is so supported in these crowds that you could imagine people weren't just clapping, but while they were clapping, they were probably just yelling the word clap. They were like, clap, 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 clap.
Clippity, cloppity, clap, clap.
Just so.
Some people with some coconuts.
Yeah, there we go. So his socialism, remember, now he's gone from what he described as Americanism, making a very good point about America, the United States itself, rather, being a consequence of going on strike, right? When you think about it, he went from Americanism to now socialism, but his critics said this was too idealistic. They said, you know, what you should be calling it is impossibilism, which is a funny word. And he said, they were saying, look, that what you are doing will, what you're proposing is never going to work. It doesn't have much to do with actual Marxism or communism. It's more like this weird utopian Walt Whitman-esque religious approach, to which he responded, what is socialism? Merely Christianity in action. It recognizes the equality in men, which is pretty dope. That's pretty cool riposte, a pretty cool response. But again, of course, not everyone agreed with him, especially if they had a lot of money and were sort of vibing with the status quo.
Well, we're in a political cycle right now. We were just talking about this, the three of us off mic, and I think we've all been subject to a lot of very alarmist political advertisements on like Hulu and various streaming services. And I bet you that at the time there might have been some who might have called Debs radical liberal. Eugene Debs mm-hmm. wants to take away your jobs because he's asking for these unreasonable requests, these unreasonable terms, mm-hmm. you know? And it's sort of like shifting the narrative, saying, you know, okay, I am the, you know, bigwig that owns the means of production, and it's just not realistic for the working people to have this kind of protection. And it's almost saying, demonizing someone like Debs for even asking for such. So it's a way of like flipping the narrative and saying like, we're the ones giving you jobs. Do you really want to piss us off? Like, I mean, without saying that exactly, right?
Yeah. It's like, hey, it'd be a shame if something happened to the existence you currently have. So, So he starts running for president himself. He's gone beyond polling for other people and hyping them up, right? It's like he has started his own political solo album. And spoiler, he doesn't do super well, but he does get some, he does garner some attention.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1900, he runs for president, and when he runs for president, Gene gets about 96,000 votes. Just for a sense of perspective, according to the census conducted the same year in 1900, the population of the U.S. was 76.3 million. So he's not, you know, he's not exactly busting down the door. Okay, so he loses that election. Fast forward 4 years, he runs again. You know, he's kind of getting one of those I can do this all day sort of tropes attached to him. This time, he gets 400,000 votes. So that's a heck of a jump, but it's still not enough to swing the needle.
I love the idea of swinging the needle and moving the pendulum. I think it's great. I think
oh, that's
works.
Right. No, you got me. No, fair play. Yeah.
So he also joined in with other union folks who might have been considered radical or militant at the time to create something and organize something called the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW. Again, AFL-CIO is an excellent resource for this information, in addition to being an excellent organization that protects a lot of these very things that we're talking about. I love this. The Wobblies was the a term used to refer to the Industrial Workers of the World, because they called on all workers to join a massive single union, like that would kind of be this like overarching umbrella, and seize control of those means of production. And if anyone follows any communist or socialist kind of meme pages, the idea of seizing the means of production is sort of a through point in a lot of those. It can't actually be used sort of hilariously in a lot of these memes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. This is also, first off, there's a lot to be said about nomenclature and branding. Even back then, it was very much the same. For some reason, it seems weird, right, when they to hear this group that wants to be very much a power to the people movement say, you know what's dependable? You know what will make people associate us with steadfastness and doggedness and being on the course? Let's just establish that we're wobbly. Let's let people know that we're sort of on a teetering thing. That's just my branding marketing note there. But this was huge. And as you can imagine, it terrified the people in power, right? The international set, banking interest, of course, mining interest, resource extractors. They couldn't let this happen. And Debs was a guy who was, you know, a real barnstormer of a speaker, but maybe not always the most diplomatic or collaborative person. He could be quite argumentative. He resigned from the Wobblies in 1908 and ran for U.S. president a third time, but he plateaus a little. Not in a bad way. He's just 1904, he gets 400,000 votes. 1908, he's still, again, not swinging the needle or moving the pendulum. And later elections are occurring. He still hasn't given up. 1910, 1912, right? There are congressional elections, and a lot of Socialist Party members are actually victorious in their state and local elections. And this inspires Debs. You know, he's always thinking, it's bigger than me. He's saying, this is our year in 1912. And in 1912, he's not just blowing smoke. Almost a million Americans voted for him for president. And just for a reference there, in 1912, the U.S. population had grown pretty significantly to 95 million people. So still not a huge percentage.
Yeah, and to jump in there, to kind of put this in framing it, to like how he wasn't that far out in this one, obviously. He got 6% of the vote, which is significant. Obviously, nowhere close to winning. Mm-hmm. This was also a really weird election where there was basically three major party candidates. There was William Howard Taft, Theodore Roosevelt, who decided to come out of retirement and run against Taft, and then our all-time favorite president on this podcast, Mr. Woodrow Wilson, who's going to come up a little bit more.
Boyhood home. Our boyhood home is in my hometown. I think I maybe mentioned that last episode, but not a great guy, right? What's the deal? He seems so innocuous and little and slight and bald. But can you explain, Max and or Ben, why this guy kind of sucked?
We can absolutely explain why he sucks. I would suggest reading articles like TalkingPointsMemo.com, Woodrow Wilson was even worse than you think, or NationalInterest.org, why Woodrow Wilson is America's worst president ever. Now, that's a hot take because there's a contest that's been going on for many, many years to figure out who was, in fact, the worst president ever. Noel, we'll do you one better than this one, man. At the very end of today's show, Max has prepared a special segment, a hit list of bad things about Woodrow Wilson. So if you feel like we're talking too much about the nuts and bolts of Eugene V. Debs, hold on. There is quite a spiteful dessert at the end. And it is.
A spiteful dessert. Is it best served cold?
Of course it is. Yes. Yeah. And
maybe it was.
And so with Debs, we see exactly what you described, Max. It's the presidential campaign is kind of a bowl of spaghetti, right? We're looking at high human drama here. There's something else interesting that occurs. The Democratic and Republican parties are starting to crib some notes and policies from socialists. So we see them embracing what were considered progressive reforms at this time, giving women the vote, busting up huge trust. That's where, you know, like one company, one entity functionally owns all of an industry. Doing economic reforms, saying stuff like people can only work up to a certain amount per week or per month. People can only get paid to a certain low threshold. Minimum wage, we call it now.
And these were novel ideas at the time, right? Like, I mean, because a lot of these things were kind of new-ish. I mean, the trusts and the giant conglomos really began with things like the railroad, which Eugene Debs had been in on since the start, at least in terms of, you know, arguing for fair treatment of workers. But this was not something that had been just like, you know, decades in the making.
Right. Yeah, this is a signal from the mainstream and their industrial puppet masters that they need to give a little to get what they want, to maintain their economic power and status quo and social hierarchies. So they also say, no more child labor. And hey, maybe you should be able to directly vote for your senator instead of just trusting us.
There's a guy against that right now. There's a guy running to get rid of that one.
Yeah. I'm aware. You know what I mean? It's always Halloween in America, man. So
people wear masks year round, I guess. Is that what you're getting at?
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah. And it's spooky. You know, you could say there's a bit of a haunted house. And that is an apolitical point. America has always, the United States, rather, has always been a grand experiment, one long improv game. So Debs is championing socialism. 1912 is what that New Yorker article we mentioned earlier by Jill Lepore. 1912 is what you could call the high water mark of socialism in the United States. And it had done something very important that doesn't often get talked about. While there was not a socialist president elected, it changed the trajectory of the two major parties. The folks who already held the power started to make some concessions to, you know, for what they saw as the greater good, which was them retaining some measure of power. Debs gets sick. He's not feeling great. He is actually too ill to run a national campaign in 1916. Because, you know, right, when we think about it, and all these guys who are running for any political office on a federal or national level, they have to travel a lot. They can't go on Zoom.
Sure. Can I ask one more question? At this time, the idea of socialism didn't have as much political kind of buzziness that it does today, because we weren't necessarily fighting with the Soviet Union like we are. You know, that legacy was not as ensconced, as established. Mm. So it wasn't like when someone established a socialist party or said, I believe in the teachings of Marx and Engels or whatever, they weren't immediately demonized the way they might be today because of our, you know, our beef with Russia and the Soviet Union.
So not yet. And what's crazy is we are literally getting on the timeline to that point right now.
Oh, yes. Because
the Bolshevik Revolution is 1917. So we are 1 year away from really, like, you know, you see this major world power get their entire government overthrown and behind socialist and communist ideas and stuff like that. And that's when, you know, we start getting like the first like Red Scare and stuff like that is about to come up in this time period.
And then later, of course, this we'll see this reflected in McCarthyism. Right. So history is a lot
quickly.
Of,
right? Like, I mean, this whole demonization happened quickly. The Red Scare was something that escalated very quickly and became this kind of witch hunt within our country.
Yeah, yeah. And this, there are multiple Red Scares throughout the history of the United States, as well as Europe. And to Max's astute point, there may well be another one on the way. Why? Why were people scared of this? Well, Debs thinks they're scared of it because there are people who are totally fine morally and ethically with damning the majority of a population into something very much like servitude because it will make their individual lives a little bit nicer. Since he can't traipse around the country running for president, he runs for Congress in his home district, a lot less travel. He comes in second. He doesn't win. He doesn't become a congressperson. And he's also a very distant second. The person who ends up beating him is a Republican, and they get way, 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 way more votes. Other socialist candidates are encountering something very similar in their neck of the woods. And it looks like his big dream of creating a union for all railroad workers and then expanding to a union of the people, of every worker, it looks like it's not going to happen.
Okay, so now we're back to Woodrow Wilson and why he sucks.
In
1917, President Woodrow Wilson, who was really only president because Teddy Roosevelt decided to come out of retirement and essentially, you know, wave around his big stick and speak very loudly, actually, and essentially sabotage the 1912 election. Wilson asked Congress to declare war on Imperial Germany and everything that went along with that, all of its allies. This was in response to what the AFL-CIO refers to as vituperative opposition.
Mm-hmm.
I need a little help with that one, fellas.
Yeah, vituperative opposition means blameworthy, basically. That they, like Congress in this sense, is being blamed or attacked for their plan, and they're being rightfully attacked because the U.S. is supposed to be a representative democracy, which means that in theory, the U.S. goes to war when the domestic population supports it. But because Congress is kind of getting caught with their hands in the military-industrial complex cookie jar of the day, they passed something called the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act says it is against the law to have a problem with the U.S. getting involved in this conflict that we now know as World War I. So for any fans of free speech, you can imagine this is a heck of a, this is a tall milkshake. Now it's illegal to have a problem, even though you live in a country that talks a big game about freedom.
And Debs was anti-war because, I mean, why wouldn't you be? And I mean, you know, we know that certain industries love war and then love politicians who are hawkish or whatever. But Debs, as someone who wanted to protect, you know, the working people, was anti-war. He says, quote, "I am opposed to every war but one. I am for that war with heart and soul, and that is the worldwide war of the social revolution. And that war, I am prepared to fight in any way the ruling class may make necessary, even to the barricades at dawn." I added at dawn, but, you know, I mean, seriously, like, this guy's got a revolutionary soul, but he doesn't want to kill anybody. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. He's all about a war of ideas. And this is really kind of the beginning of regular people being able to kind of, you know, coalesce around someone like him, like Debs, and seemingly be heard,
mm-hmm.
or at the very least, you know, have some concessions made in their favor.
Yeah, and this is the era of Joe Hill, not the tremendously accomplished fiction writer. He's a son of Stephen King, great writer, big fan. But Joe Hill, the activist and musician who is uniting people in a grassroots movement. I also want to point out vituperative doesn't just indicate that Congress got caught. It also indicates that people are talking so much trash about them. This right. is verbal abuse, right? And it's way different than the political discourse you might hear today. Even how ugly it gets in the U.S. and abroad today. Back in the day, oh gosh, we should just do something on like the weirdest political smear campaigns, right? Because
sure,
yeah, these people were fighting, and because of old boy Debs Noel, our boy Gene just violated the Espionage Act. So he gets sent up the river. But, he's arrested.
But like in a cool way, right?
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes. That it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing
right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, cool to us, I think. Yeah, Max, so
he wasn't. I mean, and it's hard to talk about a topic like this and kind of not let your stripes show a little bit. I think, we try to make the show relatively apolitical, but man, a guy like this kind of just gets my blood pumping in a good way. Debs was in fact arrested, like you said, Ben, in Cleveland in 1918 under the terms, as you said again, of the 1917 Espionage Act for a speech. For a speech. I just want to reiterate that. He didn't like he didn't do espionage. He wasn't spying. He wasn't like blowing up, you know, checkpoints or, you know, stealing classified documents. He did a speech that people didn't like. And that's when you start really going micro. You have people in power going micro on these acts. Like, how can we take this guy to the mattresses, you know, or go to the mattresses against this guy? I'm sorry, I'm messing up my my Godfather expressions here. It was a speech that he had made protesting the war that he had given on June 16th in Canton, Ohio. He apparently, as the Washington Post put it, invited arrest.
Mm. And they were like, you shouldn't have been talking that way. You knew what would happen. Yeah,
what about freedom of speech?
Right. Well, as long as it's some speech, right? Sure. I think the powers that be were more into their freedom to arrest at this point. So, yeah, so he gets, like you said, the Washington Post and other papers of the day are saying this guy is courting incarceration. And a lot of the newspapers who, let's remember, are largely controlled by these same industrial interests, they team up on him and they do some character assassination. They say, they heavily imply this guy is a budding dictator, perhaps, or what if he is a traitor to the country?
And what if?
What if? And they did something very clever, quite insidious, Machiavellian almost. They say, look, we're all good Americans, dear readers. And what he has said is so traitorous. What he has said is so seditious that we cannot in good conscience print it. And when they said that, the people who were reading had no idea what he was actually saying. He might have been like, you know what we should really be doing? We shouldn't try to protect innocent people in Europe. We should all go out and collectively like kick puppies and poop in the streets. You know what I mean?
Newborn babies our currency, you know,
right.
And punt them, you know, over the goalpost. And that's how we pay for bread.
And lick everything.
Lick
absolutely
all things. You know what? No foot privacy. People should be running up and touching strangers' feet. That's Ben, like,
what is wrong? Wow. Wow. That's a bridge too far, my friend.
Even that was too far.
We need to beep that out. That was, I'm upset. That's upsetting to me. No foot privacy? Ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, for some people in this day and age, they'd be stoked about that. I mean, foot picks are a currency of our modern day, you know, same.
Yeah. Well, shout out to the Tarantinos of the world. But our point is, like, we just made up several, I think, hilarious ideas, but things that would be messed up and terrifying if they happened in real life. And that's what that is what is occurring when people read these newspaper articles. It's like the old Hitchcock idea that the monster who is out of the frame, off the screen, is more terrifying than anything you could depict. So without knowing what this guy was saying, people were conjuring all sorts of sinister, horrific thoughts in their head, and they were associating them with our boy Gene.
In fact, it was really just kind of stuff we'd already heard him say, basically.
Right.
Maybe just a little more amped up in his rhetoric, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. He was, I mean, he was getting a little hyperbolic. You know, he was storming some barns for sure when he said stuff like, we are going to destroy all enslaving and degrading capitalist institutions and to recreate them as free and humanizing institutions. And then he said,
well, when you say things like destroy institutions, It's not too far of a walk to think he means like blow them up physically.
Right.
But I think he's speaking more figuratively, right? The idea of destroying not institutions like physical buildings, but institutions like concepts, right?
Yeah. In a way, he's like a drain the swamp dude of his age, right? And the swamp to him is corporate power and the high level nepotism of the aristocratic class in the U.S. And, you know, despite what people say about a class system in the United States, there's always been an aristocracy here. So he wants to pump up class warfare. Well, not class warfare especially, but class rights. And he talks about the working class, you know, the people who are sent to fight, the people who have to actually die on the front lines. He says they don't have a voice in deciding whether or not to go to war. and I am super not loving it. We're paraphrasing, but that's where he's going. So he goes to jail. He's not the only one. Thousands of anti-war activists and socialists get jammed up during the First World War. And then, like you mentioned, Noel, the Red Scare. And what we see is strange because at this point, Uncle Sam is essentially trying to outlaw an ideology. They're trying to outlaw socialism as a, it's like thought crime.
Well, so the thing that I was talking about earlier, where it's like we hadn't quite gotten there yet, now we're really getting there because they're like, oh, shit. They sort of slept on it, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was like they didn't quite realize how antithetical to the institutions that Uncle Sam relies on, you know? And Uncle Sam always was kind of like a symbol of like equality and like, you know, American stick-to-itiveness and all of that. But what Uncle Sam ultimately became was just kind of this representation of the powered class, you know, whether yeah. those be politicians or, you know, the moneyed hierarchy of industry.
100%. And this is okay. So we're maybe lionizing or deifying Debs a little bit, but he's still him. You know what I mean? He's still his version of Jenny from the Block. He goes to court, and this is like a dum 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 kind of moment. Yeah, there it is.
Sexy, sexy justice and justice. Oh, sorry, okay, I got it. Yeah,
Dick Wolf. Oh, so this is a moment where he goes to court. And he's got an attorney, and his attorney's getting kind of hyperbolic. His attorney basically compares Eugene Debs to Jesus Christ. And there's no one. I know that's the entry point. They're breaking the ice. No one gets called to the stand but Gene. And Gene's testimony is a 2-hour speech with like no interruptions, which I cannot imagine that happening in a like that does feel like a fake Law and Order courtroom situation. 2 hours? 2 hours, man, on the stand? What do you think?
This is a little unrelated, but it just does kind of point to the power of speaking up in court like that because it becomes part of record and mm-hmm. people react. You know, the jury reacts, the litigators react, the judge reacts. And I saw a thing where, remember Murder Was the Case, you know, Tupac?
Yeah.
He actually went to court for murder and he didn't say a thing throughout the entire case until the very end when he stood up and said something to the effect of, this hasn't been justice. He essentially said, this is a kangaroo court. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, my fate is not in your hands. My fate is in God's hands. And it was just the most baller kind of like, you know, I know that I'm, you know, righteous here. And again, I don't know even what came of that case. I mean, he obviously didn't go to prison or get the death penalty. I think he was acquitted, if I'm not mistaken. But this is that level of like, you know, he's going to have his moments and people right. have to pay attention because it's part of public record.
You're out of order. This whole court is out of order. This whole country is out of order. Also, what's next? Airplane food. When those get invented, this is going to be nuts. So, he says, I believe in free speech. I believe in war as well as peace. And if this espionage law stands, then our constitution is dead.
That's what we were getting at earlier.
Yeah.
It was used as a workaround to jam this guy up. It was not the letter and spirit of the act. It was a way of like literally shutting down free speech. So what he's saying, whether you agree with him or not, you know, holds true. How can you do espionage? Isn't something you do in public. Espionage is something you do in the shadows. Mm-hmm. So to call making a speech saying something unpopular, to call that espionage is absurd.
I agree with you because they're trying to sabotage an idea. A war on an idea is a very difficult war to win. There's one line that I think, I know this really speaks to you, Max. I think it speaks to Noel and I as well. And it's something I've always remembered since I first learned about this guy from his address. It comes to us via another socialist named Max Eastman. It's this: while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Again, take him to church.
Yeah, man. And it's funny, too, because if you look up images of Eugene Debs, I mean, he's a wiry, slight kind of fellow where he might as well have elbow patches, you know. he really does look like a, you know, a professor. So he doesn't have the idea of casting him as like a would-be dictator, which is ironic, that kind of rhetoric, because he's couldn't be more anti-dictator, you know, because I mean, we have these de facto dictators in the history of our country, in these captains of industry, you know, they are these folks that there are no checks and balances. And we have this illusion of checks and balances kind of in the government, but within industry, there really aren't. We were even in the earliest days of things like regulatory boards and things that are kind of calling industrial, you know, giants to task in terms of what they're doing to the planet and what they're doing to the working people. So you have this kind of shadow government within industry that essentially they are these dictators. So it's hilarious to try to cast this slight little professorial dude as like a would-be dictator.
Yeah. And then let's also consider that, importantly, a lot of countries that would go on to practice what you would see as communism or some blend of socialism, a lot of them later failed, right? So it was easy to point to those experiments and say, hey, watch out, be scared, because if you want these things, like better labor laws, then the next thing you know, you're essentially going to be forced into serfdom, like over in the USSR. So there was a lot, this is ideological warfare. His speech, though it is dope and rousing for many people in the crowd, it doesn't persuade the judge. So the Espionage Act, whether or not you agree that it is morally just, is legal. It is the law of the land. So he gets sent back up the river for 10 years. He's taken from Cleveland to a prison out in West Virginia. And then later, they send him down here to Atlanta, to the infamous Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, a very messed up place to live. He's stuck in a shoebox-sized cell with five other dudes.
Isn't that the one that's still standing?
It's
like, it's very like gothic. It's like over by the good taco place.
Yeah. The prison taco place. Yeah. Everybody loves it. Yeah. It's so good.
That place is what's the word I'm looking for? Striking. There's got to be a better word,
but foreboding? It's just this,
yes, foreboding. It's very Gotham City. You know, it's like, it looks like a weird Dracula castle.
Yeah. That's a good description. And, so he's there, and this is way before the taco place is built, but try it when you come into town, folks. Let us know. We'll meet you up there. He says, don't give me any special treatment. I wasn't just styling on it when I was talking in court. You know, if there's a criminal element, let me be of it. Let me be part of what you call the lowest. And they say, yeah, right on, man. So you're going to be in this cell for 14 hours a day. And we'll let you walk out in the prison yard 20 minutes every 24 hours. The nutritional value of what they're feeding prisoners there is very, very bad. So he is gradually growing malnourished and weak. And like you pointed out, Noel, he doesn't have the best constitution to begin with. So he starts to think, holy smokes, the people I've met in this prison, they're not necessarily bad people. They have, in fact, a lot in common with the guys I worked with in my railroad days. He says, it's a cross-section of society. You can see every version of humanity here. And he says, you know what? Also, I kind of like how this prison I'm in is a model of equality because we're all in the same terrible situation.
Right. Yeah, it's true. It really does kind of even the playing field. I mean, you know, there are, obviously we know there are certain folks in prison that get more privileges because of connections and skill sets or, you know, the Andy Dufresnes of the world and all of that. But in general, you really do have to bootstrap yourself and, like, you know, become valuable in a very specific way in prison.
Yeah. And of course, this is not to in any way diminish the horrors of incarceration, which are, you know, many, right? The risk of physical violence, the dangers of infection and disease. These are very real problems back then as well as today. He becomes this, he has something really interesting. He becomes an ultimate champion of equality, right? And this is what he's talking about in his later writings. So this makes him a martyr. This makes him a folk hero. He's a champion of free speech. He runs for president again. That's right. Don't call it a comeback. 1920, this dude is in jail and he runs for president. He gets nearly a million votes as convict number 9653. We did a slight mention of it in part one and we paid it off.
And as the New Yorker puts it in this article that we referenced by Jill Lepore, a vote for Debs at that point was not a vote for the Socialist Party. It was a vote for free speech. Because again, whether you, you know, buy into the various intricacies of socialism, which there are many, what he was truly fighting for here was having his free speech shut down.
Yeah. Yeah. And he probably at this point, given the national support he garnered, he conceivably could ask for a pardon and it probably would have been granted. Right. If he had made some sort of public mea culpa, right, and sort of diffused the bomb of this activist movement. But he said, nah, dog, that's a pass for me, or that's a no for me, dog. And he grew sicker, he grew weaker day in, day out. People began holding these free Gene rallies. Well, they called them free Deb rallies. But right. Yeah, President Woodrow Wilson, again, famously a dick. He refused to answer any of these national calls for just amnesty, right? You can say that he's still guilty, but let this guy out of jail before he dies or prison. It would take a different administration. Warren Harding's administration releases him on Christmas Day, 1921, but the damage to his frail condition was done. He never recovered. He lived in a sanatorium for the rest of his life. In 1925, he said the Socialist Party was pretty much dead in the U.S., and the next year, he passed away.
But, you know, to this day, I think we have in Bernie Sanders sort of a Eugene Debs analog in that he really, you know, made a splash in the kind of mainstream political stage. And he obviously didn't win, but just by virtue of like him being out there kind of spreading these kinds of ideas, I think he made a big impact. And I think Eugene V. Debs would have been proud. And I don't know this for a fact, but I can't imagine that Sanders isn't a student of Debs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because while this might sound like a story that is ultimately a story of failure, it's not really, because the legacy continued on. You know what I mean? It's like the idea of seeing an apple fall to the ground and thinking, ah, dang, what a waste of an apple. But every apple has seeds, as did the beliefs of Debs. And those seeds took root. God, that's a painful analogy, but I hope we're painting the picture. And they grew into things like new generations of social reformers who spearheaded stuff like the New Deal, which saved the United States in the 1930s. And this becomes part of the great, at times contradictory, historical anatomy of the United States, of the country in which we live. And at this point, you know, because I don't want to sound sanctimonious or TED talky, at this point, I think we tip our hats to Eugene V. Debs. Whether or not you agree with him, you have to respect that he kept it real the whole way through. And we can end on a lighter note. Gentlemen, Noel, Max,
yes.
is it time for our spiteful dessert?
It is best served cold, as Noel said.
Okay. All right. So Woodrow Wilson fans, if you are somehow still listening to this episode, we would like to share with you some excellent research that Max did, Noel and I did a little on our own as well. We wanted to end this episode with just a quick list of reasons we think Woodrow Wilson just sucks. Just sucks as a person. Not even a president. Oh my gosh.
Max, I think you should lead. I mean, this is your baby.
Yeah. Woodrow Wilson really sucks. So the article I'm going to be referencing for most of this is a Vox article titled "Woodrow Wilson Was Extremely Racist, Even by the Standards of His Time."
It was so
compared to people around him at the time. Because, you know, that's one of the hard things about going through history of people and be like, it's like, well, they were not as racist as everyone else. But Woodrow Wilson was so racist that everyone around him was like, wow, this guy is so ridiculously racist. So one thing he did, I did not know about this.
Hmm.
But, you know, Reconstruction, all that era stuff, there was a lot of this stuff was still in place. And unfortunately, a lot of it would be carved away throughout these decades. And one of the main people to do that, Woodrow Wilson, he resegregated the federal government. He fired, or at least put in action, the firing of 15 of the 17 black supervisors in all the federal service. There's only 17 black supervisors, so there's not many, that many of them. And by the time he was done, 15 of them were gone.
He was like, too far. He also, he was like how Lovecraft was really racist for a large part of his life.
Right.
Lovecraft was so racist that he made other racists uncomfortable. And that's kind of the Woodrow Wilson vibe. This is astonishing because he also tried to high road people, right? When he got confronted by black Americans who saw the threat of his weird crush on segregation, he told them, what did he say, Max? You should do the quote.
Oh, no, I have to read this one. He said, and I'm not going to try an accent, "Segregation is not humiliating, but a benefit and ought to be so regarded by you gentlemen."
Woof.
And see, guys, I actually have another one. I have a secret one from this article that I did not list on here. It's so bad that I left out the side. But supposedly there was this black gentleman whose job was deemed so essential they couldn't fire him.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, well, we have to, or they couldn't fire him and they couldn't move him into another department. He like worked so interconnected with everyone else in the department who was, by the way, white. They're like, okay, so we have to leave him here, but we still have to segregate him. So they put this man in a cage in a federal office building. It is listed in this article. This man doing his job working for the federal government was put in a cage while he worked.
Insane. Inhuman.
Not to mention he was a vocal defender of the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, right. Yeah, that part.
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson really loved the Klan. He really loved the Confederacy. He was kind of just like obsessed with this whole lost cause thing where, you know, this idea that like the Confederacy losing the Civil War, there was this noble cause that they were fighting for, blah, 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 all this BS that does not stand up to any scrutiny whatsoever. And he really wanted to install these ideas and everything.
He thought that the Confederacy was a pretty good idea. He said, look, these are bucolic, like philosopher kings of an agrarian society, and these northern industrialists just don't get it. Wilson's an academic, but being an academic doesn't necessarily, being intelligent does not necessarily make you a good person. He was really into what is called lost cause mythology, which is like the South was right kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it occurs to me, Eugene V. Debs and you and Woodrow Wilson weirdly resembled one another.
Yeah, they look alike, kind of.
It's like a Marvel film where the hero and the villain have similar world, powers.
You know? They could have existed in like in metaverse kind of, or not mess, God, in alternate kind of universe scenarios.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Multiverse.
Thank you. Not metaverse.
Yeah, screw the metaverse.
But man, what a ride. I can't believe we I can believe that we pulled two episodes out of this, and I think each one has, you know, something very special because this guy's early life was its own thing, and then his history. I got to say, too, that one of the things I did to research for this, I found a dude on this history YouTube channel who's like a Eugene V. Debs impersonator, and sort of like in The Office where there was
Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin impersonator, exactly. This guy does these talks in character, and then afterwards he was interviewed not in character, and he pointed out that he did the version of Debs that was sort of more long in the tooth because he didn't feel like he could possibly ever match the rhetoric, the rhetorical fire that kind of more young Eugene Debs brought.
100%, yeah. And this is worth watching, by the way, to get a sense of Debs, what Noel's talking about here. We talked earlier, I love the reenactments. I love those towns. I love the historical figures. I'm a sucker for that. But even I would probably skip a Woodrow Wilson reenactment. And with that, I think we're gonna call it a date. This has been a crazy week for us, but it's thoroughly enjoyable. We cannot wait to get to some of our future episodes. Couple of spoilers for you ridiculous historians. We're getting into hot tubs, figuratively and maybe literally. We're also going deep into the story of condiments. I'm so gassed, man.
Oh, man. And literally just by hearing you say that now, I think we need to also do an episode on the story of condoms. Because we know that could in and of itself be an interesting tale.
You know, what about condoms filled with condiments?
Gross.
In a hot tub?
Nope. I'm going to stop you right there.
Wow.
I'm going to stop you right there. It's a family show. Family show. Huge thanks to super producer Max Williams stopping him short of just totally ruining my mind. Alex Williams, who composed this theme?
Dr. Zach Williams, no relation, as well as Jeff Bartlett. Big thanks to our research associate team. Thanks to our long-suffering friend and self-appointed nemesis, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quizster. Thanks to Debs. Thanks to our ridiculous historians for tuning in. Noel, thanks to you, man.
Hey, and you as well. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.